been here. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Shaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gaudavani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatadesha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar. Are you all situated in such a way that you can see? If you want to bring your chairs around to take a spot where you can see. Ladies are okay, they can see from, or are you too far back? It's okay? Okay. Yeah. This is something we'll come back to later. In fact, I have to turn them off one by one, or they'll be exploding while we're speaking. Is this the last one? Where's the last one? Okay. Let's get some light on the subject. Not that light. Good. Let me just check one thing. I'm not getting electrical power. Oh, that's why I'm not getting electrical power. Easy to understand. Okay. Come in. So the discussion centers around what's perhaps one of the signature events of our time. Kadambakana Namaraj ki jai. What's perhaps one of the signature events of our time, the destruction of the World Trade Center and the attack on the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. We're going to discuss these events in relationship to the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The 16th chapter is called The Divine and Demonic Natures, Daivasura Sampad. First, Krishna talks about the divine qualities. Abhayam sattva samshudhir jnana yoga vyavastitihi. Then, danam tamascha yagyascha svadhyaya tapa arjavam. Starting with fearlessness, a person with the divine qualities is free from fear. He knows he's not this body. He knows that material life is temporary. He knows Krishna is there. He's fearless. And sattva sangshuddhi, purification of one's existence. The godly persons act with that purpose. And jnana yoga vyavastitihi, cultivation of spiritual knowledge. Dhanam, charity, giving to others. Tamas, self-control. Yajna, sacrifice for the sake of the Supreme. Svadhyay, study of scriptural wisdom. Tapa, austerity. And arjavam, straightforwardness. What you see is what you get. Ahimsa, nonviolence. Satyam, truthfulness. Akrodha, freedom from anger. Tyaga, renunciation. Then, shanti, tranquility, and apaishunam, not a fault finder, doesn't like to do that. And compassion for all living beings. What's there? Dayabhuteshu. And aloluptva. He's free from greed. Not greedy. Doesn't take more than he needs. Gentle. Mardavan. And free modesty. Achapalam. He's not flickering. Steady in his determination. Vigorous. He has forgiveness, fortitude, cleanliness, freedom from envy, and freedom from the passion for honor. Lord Krishna says these are the daivi sampad, the divine qualities, and they lead toward liberation. Daivi sampad vimokshaya. From the very beginning, the persons who are of the divine nature show these qualities. But there are always two kinds of people in the world. Just as in the state there are the law-abiding citizens and the outlaws, so in the state of the universe there are the godly persons and the demonic. Vishnu bhakta smita daiva, asuras tad viparyayo. The persons who are the devotees of the Supreme Lord are the devas, the godly persons. And asuras tad viparyayo. The asuras are just the opposite. Even if they may appear to have some good qualities, because they're against the Lord, they're demons. Just Hiranyakashipu, one of the divine qualities is austerity. Hiranyakashipu was austere, but he was against the Lord. Ravana was a Brahmin, but he was against the Lord. So the real quality of the Daivi Sampad, he's a devotee of the Lord, and therefore he develops all these good qualities. Yas yasti bhaktir bhagavat chikinchana sarvai gunaistatra samasute sura harava bhaktasya kuto mahaguna. The demonic persons have just the opposite qualities. Dambha, pride. Darpa, arrogance. Abhiman, conceit. Krodha, anger. Parusham, harshness. And agana. The basic principle of their life is ignorance. So, daivi sampad vimokshaya asuri nimbantaya surimata. The divine qualities lead to liberation, and the demonic qualities lead to bondage. This is the summary given by Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, and he elaborates especially on the demonic qualities in the rest of the chapter. Pravrittim cha nivrittim cha jana navidurasura nashocham napi cha charo na satyam teshu vidyate. They don't know what's to be done, what's not to be done. They're filthy. They don't act properly. Na satyam, they're liars. You can't expect any truth out of them. These are demonic qualities. What is that? Alpa buddhaya prabhavanti ugra karmanaha kshayaya jagatohita. Let's see, I missed a word there. nashtatmanopabuddhayah. That's what it is. Etam drishtim avashtabhya, nashtatma, lost to themselves, their spiritual, their souls are lost. Alpabuddhi, no brains. And ugra karma, they're engaged in nasty, vicious activities. Kshayaya jagato hita, against the welfare of the world and just meant to bring violence and destruction. This is a statement from first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam written by Srila Prabhupada in the 1960s before he came to America. Prabhupada said the asuras want to enjoy a life of sense gratification, even at the cost of others' happiness. In order to fulfill this ambition, the asuras, especially atheistic kings or state executive heads, try to equip themselves with all kinds of deadly weapons to bring about a war in a peaceful society. They have no ambition other than personal aggrandizement and satisfy their own senses. And thus Mother Earth feels overburdened by such undue increases of military strength. We know that's why Krishna came. Once the world was overburdened by the unnecessary force of asuras who were pretending to be kings, but who were actually demons. Well, this is a statement by Prabhupada. Now we bring this around to 9/11. The number of people with medical problems linked to the 9/11 attacks on New York has risen to at least 15,000 as of 2006. On Tuesday, a coroner said the death of a policeman who developed a respiratory disease was directly linked to 9/11. Tests revealed the dust all over the place in Manhattan to be extremely alkaline with a pH of 12.1 out of 14, and some of it was as caustic as liquid drain cleaner. It was obvious that precautions had to be taken to protect the workers and people returning to their homes from the dust. That's Greg Swayze of the U.S. Geological Survey. Sam Vance, an environmental scientist with the Environmental Protection Agency, sent the results to officials at the EPA. At the White House's direction, the Environmental Protection Agency gave New Yorkers misleading assurances that there was no health risk from the debris-laden air after the World Trade Center collapse. The White House convinced EPA to add reassuring statements and delete cautionary ones by having the National Security Council control EPA communications after the terror attacks. By the way, I have no political affiliations. I'm not for the Democrats or the Republicans any more than I'm for the BJP or the Congress Party. But these are the reassurances given according to the government's own inspector. In all, the EPA issued 5 news releases within 10 days of the attacks, 4 more by the end of 2001, reassuring the public about air quality. I am glad to reassure the people of New York and Washington, D.C., that their air is safe to breathe and their water is safe to drink. Christy Todd Whitman, she was the head of the Environmental Protection Agency at the time. Soon, respiratory ailments and other problems began to surface in hundreds. It was much more important to open up Wall Street than it was to worry about our health, said former city council person Catherine Freed. We've known it was a cover-up since the beginning, said Mr. Jain, the president of the local residents' coalition. We were dying, and the government was talking about not scaring people, said Mr. Moore, who suffers from asthma, lung disease, and other ailments. It was a cover-up. This is, by the way, from the New York Daily News, which is probably the most, the biggest newspaper in New York City. So this is mainline information. There's nothing esoteric about this. This is well known. What do you think? Divine qualities or demonic qualities? Yeah, all who vote for divine? Yeah, you think this was divine? Yeah, demonic. Okay. Anyone want to make a case for it being divine? Okay, demonic qualities. But we're going to go deeper. This building, how many buildings fell in New York on 9/11? Two? Three. The North Tower, the South Tower, and World Trade Center building number 7. You might recognize this building from an earlier clip. That's World Trade Center building number 7, which collapsed at about 5:30 in the evening. That's good. I'll bring you with you, you with me wherever I go. Very good. This building was not hit by a plane. It suffered some damage from flying debris from the World Trade Centers. It had some fire in it, and it collapsed just like that. In the evening. How many skyscrapers in the history of the world have fallen due to fire? How many steel skyscrapers in the history of the world have fallen due to fire? How many? Well, according to official reckoning, 3. World Trade Center 1, World Trade Center 2, and World Trade Center 7. In fairness, 1 and 2 were also hit by airplanes, so it wasn't just fire, although the official accounts say that the buildings actually withstood the impact of the planes and fell because of the fire started by the planes. That leaves one building in the history of the world that's fallen only due to fire. One skyscraper building, WTC 7. This is the report from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. The specifics of the fires in WTC 7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. And then in the report, they give maybe 3 or 4 possible ways that the building could have fallen. This could have happened, that could have happened, this could have been weakened by that, and then this or that. They give 3 or 4 possibilities, and then they conclude, the best hypothesis has only a low probability of occurrence, which is translated as, no way any of this actually happened. Interesting. Event. There have been other buildings hit by fire. In 1988, big bank in Los Angeles burned out of control for 3.5 hours. 4 floors were gutted. In 1991, big building in Philadelphia, 18-hour fire, 8 floors gutted. Neither building fell. Some people have raised questions about the speed with which this building fell. It was a 47-story building. It collapsed in 6.5 seconds. 6.5 seconds is not really a very long time. You could hardly finish 2 sentences in 6.5 seconds. Freefall time, that means the time that if you took a brick and dropped it off the roof, it would take before it hit the ground. If you were in a vacuum, without air resistance, a brick dropped from the roof would hit the ground in 5.96 seconds. So there's about a half second, in other words, no difference. This entire building fell essentially at freefall speed. The North Tower fell in 11 seconds, South Tower, 9 seconds. Free fall time for those buildings is about 9.22 seconds. Things happened very quickly. And people have raised questions about how such buildings could fall so fast. Another question that has been raised about these events of 9/11 concern America's military response. America's has the most powerful air defense force in the world, and it has protocols for what happens when a plane is off course. There's a handbook with procedures about what you do when an airplane is off course. Essentially, they have these what they call fixes, which are imaginary points that the plane has to pass through on its way from its origin to its destination. And if a plane misses a fix, and especially if a plane misses a fix by a considerable distance, all the lights start flashing at air traffic control. All the lights start flashing. The first thing they do is they call the pilot. You know, flight 72, flight 72. The next thing they do is they call the United States military. And within a couple of minutes, the military has planes up there following that aircraft. And especially if the aircraft, if its transponder, its little beeper, isn't beeping, the air traffic controllers assume, their instruction is to assume the worst. Assume that the pilot has had a heart attack or that terrorists have taken over the plane. Assume that something is seriously wrong. Because if you make a mistake that way, it's okay if you make the other mistake. So they send up these F-15s, and the F-15s run ahead of the aircraft and rock their wings. That's a sign that, you know, I want your attention, and I want you to follow me down to the ground, to the nearest airport. And then you rock your wings back, saying, okay. If you don't rock your wings back, things quickly escalate to the point where your aircraft may be shot down. You know, first there's a warning shot, you know, there's a sequence. On September 11th, with 4 planes hijacked, where were the interceptors? The United States military gave several explanations. First, they said the FAA, the Federal Aviation Agency, they didn't tell us. They didn't give us enough time. They dilly-dallied. That was their first story, until a woman from the FAA who'd been attending the press conferences and collecting the business cards of the media people present, sent off an email to all the people who were attending, saying, in a sense, damn it, those people were tapped in to a phone bridge within moments. The Department of Defense, everybody was online within moments. Don't blame it on us. Well, it wasn't actually that the FAA didn't inform us, but they, and then they had like three other different stories, one after another, each one abandoned when it was shown to be impossible. Now there's, I think they're on Rev 4 of what happened. In any case, they missed the boat. The head of the Air Force for Russia said that if it had been our country, you know, they'd have been down. And anyone who's been to Russia knows that Russia does not have it together the way America does. So where were these planes? That's the second question. There's a third question. There are lots of questions. I'm just giving you some samples. This building is well known, the United States Pentagon, the head of the military headquarters of the United States military establishment, looking like a big, well, like a five-sided target or something. In the last few minutes, Flight 77, which is the plane that smashed into the Pentagon, descended 7,000 feet, executed a 270-degree turn, basically a U-turn, skimmed just over the Pentagon lawn, and slammed into the building's west wing. There are some questions about this. The first question is this. Imagine yourself a terrorist pilot. I know you're all godly people, but just for a moment. Imagine yourself, you know, a terrorist pilot. You're on a mission for Allah. Somehow or other, you've gotten into the United States without being detected as what you really are. You've gone to flight school without anybody figuring out why you were going. You've gotten through security at Boston Airport and Washington Airport, and you've gotten onto the planes without being detected, and you've succeeded in hijacking the planes. You've killed the pilot, you've stabbed the flight attendants, you've done it. You've held off the passengers, and you've taken charge of this plane. You have no idea how many minutes you have left or how many seconds you have left before the F-15s shoot you down. And there in front of you is your target, the United States Pentagon. Now, what do you do for Allah? Do you do a 270-degree turn, skim right over the lawn at the risk of crashing your plane, and then slam into the one side of the building, and that also the one side that was known to be under construction for the last year or several years, and therefore to have essentially no people in it, and to be the strongest side of the building? Do you do that? And by the way, and the brass, the big guys are all in the east wing. So do you risk everything with this fancy turn and skimming over the lawn in order to bang into the most useless side of the building? Or do you go, boom, right into the center of the thing, straight down, causing enormous damage on all five sides, and without risking a crash as you skim over the lawn? Okay, terrorists, which choice do you make? Right. Well, that's not what they did. But that's only the beginning. Let's meet the pilot. This is the terrorist pilot, Hani Hanjour. I couldn't believe he had a commercial license of any kind with the skills that he had, said Peggy Chevrette, Arizona flight school manager.
I'm still to this day amazed that he could have flown into the Pentagon, the former flight school employee said. He couldn't fly at all. A month or so before this flight into the Pentagon, Hani Hanjour had gone to another flight school to check out a plane, you know, to do a few laps around the pool, as they say, you know, little hours practice. So in accordance with the flight school's rules, the flight school sent him up with a co-pilot, as their insurance company required, to make sure that this guy was okay flying the plane. They refused to rent it to him. The guy's skills were so bad that they wouldn't rent him a plane. And the plane we're talking about is a Cessna. Those who know what a Cessna is, it's those little business jets with two little engines, and they're, you know, like from there to here. We carry six or eight passengers, you know, little light aircraft. He couldn't fly one of those. And yet, on 9/11, he did this 7,000-foot dive, 270-degree turn, skimmed just over the Pentagon lawn in a 757, and smashed into the West Wing. I meet a lot of pilots, and from what they tell me, a 757 can do all of that in the hands of an experienced pilot. But a 757 handles completely differently from a Cessna, the kind of plane Mr. Hanjour trained on. You know, it's got a different weight, different aerodynamics when you pull back on the controls. It doesn't respond the same way any more than an elephant responds the same way as a donkey. So anyway, Allah must be really wonderful because his devotee managed to pull off this miraculous attack on the Pentagon. Moving on. We're going to look at a little bit of world politics here, some geopolitics. We're going to be looking at Eurasia with the help of Zbigniew Brzezinski. You might not remember Dr. Brzezinski. He was the national security advisor to the Carter administration several terms back. Very brilliant person. And he wrote a book in 1977 called The Grand Chessboard. So we're going to learn a little bit about the world from him. This is Eurasia. It starts all the way over there on the east with Japan and extends all the way over to the west to the United Kingdom and so on. It's basically all of Europe and Asia put together. That's Eurasia. As Dr. Brzezinski points out, it's got most of the territory in the world. It's got by far most of the people. It's got the lion's share of the gross national product. In other words, it's got most of the money and resources in the world. Eurasia is the chessboard on which the struggle for global primacy continues to be played. The struggle to be number one. This is the chessboard on which the game is played. Not Australia, or Africa, or South America, or even North America. This is the place, and has been the place since, you know, practically all of history. The issue of how a globally engaged America copes with the complex Eurasian power relationships remains central to America's capacity to exercise global primacy. Okay? How we deal with Eurasia is very important in ensuring that we stay number one. it is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus also of challenging America. So America really wants to be top dog. But there are some limits. This is Dr. Brzezinski. America is too democratic at home to be autocratic abroad. This limits the use of America's power, especially its capacity for military intimidation. Never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy. The pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion. Except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenge to the public's sense of domestic well-being. This is another interesting item. Clinton administration, when the Democratic Party was in power, the Republicans were out of power, and a group of leading Republicans formed a think tank in Washington called the Project for the New American Century. It's what's called in American political terms a neoconservative Republican think tank. It's way on the right, you know, basically America, America. And in fact, their idea was that we've reached a unique point in history. Never before has there been one global superpower and only one. And now it's happened, and we're it. And our responsibility, our duty, is to make sure that we stay number one and that we consolidate and expand our global strength. We should have full spectrum dominance. We should be number one on land, number one in the air, number one on the water, number one on space. We should have control in all directions, up, down, all the 16 directions we should control. That's their idea. These were some of the members of that think tank: the future Vice President of the United States, the future Secretary of Defense, future Deputy Secretary of Defense, future Chief of Staff for the Vice President, and the brother of the future President, Mr. Bush. Well, these are all now big names because these are the people who essentially became the leaders of the United States government. The think tank published a document in the year 2000 which called for radically expanding American military power. If you want to achieve those goals, you can't do it with the relatively small military that America has now, big as it is. You have to expand it. We need more money for space. We need more money for the Army. We need more money for every branch of the United States military. But, the report said, this process of transformation to a larger force is likely to be a long one. Absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor, you'll remember, it was the attack that brought America into the Second World War. On September 11th, 2001, such a catastrophic and catalyzing event took place. After 9/11, we had the attack on Afghanistan, the war on Iraq, semi-permanent U.S. military presence in the Middle East, boosted budget for the U.S. Space Command, blank check for military budgets overall. Congress essentially met within the next few days and said, tell us how much you want. And the Afghan pipeline. Who's familiar with the Afghan pipeline? Okay, one, two. Here's the Afghan pipeline. It starts over in the Caspian Sea on the left, runs through Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan to the Arabian Sea. It represents, first of all, an enormous building project, one of those multi-trillion-dollar building projects running through, you know, four countries that way. And it pumps an enormous amount of natural gas through the region. With improved regional security after the fall of the Taliban a year ago, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan have decided to push ahead with plans for the ambitious 1,500-kilometer-long gas pipeline. For improved regional security, read the presence of the United States military, whose presence, if I drew a red line through the region that traced where the United States military was, that line would hardly be different from the line you see on the screen now. This was a deal the United States government had been trying to get through for many, many years, and the Taliban had stood in the way. Coincidence. After 9/11, also, the Patriot Act, I don't know if you here in India are that familiar with the Patriot Act. It's a very strangely named act, which essentially strips American citizens of various crucial liberties guaranteed for them in the founding documents of the United States of America. It allows unannounced searches. It allows unannounced tapping of your telephone. It allows people to be arrested and held indefinitely. It allows the government to track what books you check out from the library. All of this in the name of protecting America from terrorism. So that's called the Patriot Act. Identity documents needed for travel. Now you can't get on a train or a bus or a plane in America without having photo ID. And they're working on, in fact, they will require by 2008 electronic photo ID that lets them keep track of where you are at any time. Biometric passports. Biometric means it's got all sorts of physical data built into the passport in a little electronic strip, so you can't cheat. They've got you. And terror alerts, which have become part of the American way of life. On the television, you'll see what this stage of terror alert is on any given day, whether it's elevated, high, or severe. It's never low. and surely there must be more to come. So there are three possible explanations for all this. Actually, there's a fourth explanation. The fourth explanation is that whatever the United States government is telling us about all this is quite true. That America is conducting a global war on terror to protect the citizens, not only of its own country, but the citizens of the world, to protect democracy and freedom everywhere. That's one possibility. In a recent newspaper poll, it was found that 16% of the people of America believe that to be true. If America were fighting a war on terrorism, it would certainly be at war with Pakistan, who's a known terrorist country. It would be at war with Israel, which, for good or bad reasons, it even admits that it uses terrorist techniques. It would be at war with various regimes in South America that are essentially puppets of the United States government itself. And finally, the United States would be at war with itself. Because the United States is hardly an argument, the biggest terrorist country in the world. The United States introduced the car bomb into the Middle East. If we go back some decades, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were civilian targets, and the definition of terrorism is military action against civilians for achieving a military or political objective. So you have to assume that America is not conducting a legitimate global war on terrorism. So I haven't even included that as one of the possibilities. That's too far out. So that leaves three possibilities left. The first is that an unforeseen terrorist attack took place, and to advance America's global agenda, the United States government made the most of it. It's known that they already had the plans for invading Afghanistan on the shelf before 9/11, and most of the other stuff, Iraq, well, this was all there. So we could say that, well, they had these plans, but they really couldn't carry them out for lack of a proper opportunity, lack of public support. But when this terrible thing happened, and who could have known that it would happen, when it happened, the America's leaders just made the most of it and said, aha, now we've got our chance. That's possibility one. Possibility two. Persons within the United States government had foreknowledge of the attack and yet let it occur. And without going into details in the short time available, there's considerable evidence to suggest that this second possibility is worth serious consideration. There's also a third possibility worthy of serious consideration, again with considerable evidence to suggest that it could very well be true, and that is that members of the United States government actively took part in arranging the attack. For achieving such important geopolitical goals, they would not simply rely on others to make something good happen sooner or later, but they themselves orchestrated these events. These, I think, are the only three real possibilities. Maybe, yes. And whichever of the three you take, how many of them reflect the divine nature? You've got demonic possibility number one, demonic possibility number two, maybe demonic possibility number one, super demonic possibility number two, and ultra demonic possibility number three. I present this to illustrate that when Krishna is speaking in Bhagavad Gita about the demonic nature, he's not speaking about, you know, some people from other planets with weird shapes and mystic powers, nor is he speaking about some, you know, kind of people who aren't very nice, who have some bad qualities. But he's speaking of people who are loathsome, vile, vicious in their activities, who will do anything. Prabhupada said, for their sense gratification, they will do anything. A tidbit, it's not in this presentation, made mostly for Americans, but just for your information. On 9/11, one of the people who happened to be in Washington, D.C., was a fellow named General Mahmood, who's the head of, or was at the time, the head of the ISI, Pakistani intelligence. And one Indian reporter attended a White House press briefing. I saw the clip, and asked, I believe it was the Secretary of Defense, Miss Rice, or perhaps it was one of her people, is it true that General Mahmood, the head of the ISI, was in Washington on 9/11? And if so, what were you talking with him about? And she just dodged that question the way your fancy Indian drivers dodge vehicles on the road. You know, she just zoom, 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 zoom. Didn't answer the question. What was more spicy is that when the transcript of the press conference was published by the United States government, that portion read like this: is it true that inaudible was present in Washington on 9/11? In brackets, inaudible. I saw the film clip. It was perfectly audible to me. And I have a hearing deficiency. And what makes this still more interesting is that a couple of weeks before 9/11, General Mahmood had wired $400,000 to to Muhammad Atta, who was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Interesting, huh? This is a relevant statement. Of course, the people don't want war, but they can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. That's from Hermann Göring, 18th April, 1946. Nazi Reichmaster. All of this proves some Vedic assertions. We know from our philosophy that there's a tendency to be illusioned. According to a recent newspaper poll, one out of three Americans favors either the second possibility we talked about, that they let it happen on purpose, Or the third, they made it happen on purpose. So either one out of three Americans is under an illusion, or two out of three. Or, I would argue, three out of three. However you look at it, illusion is busily at work. Coming back to Srila Prabhupada's statement, the asuras want to enjoy a life of sense gratification, even at the cost of others' happiness. They try to equip themselves with all kinds of deadly weapons to bring about a war in a peaceful society. They have no ambition other than personal aggrandizement. And thus, Mother Earth feels overburdened by such undue increases of military strength. So it comes to a question about what to do about this. I've given this presentation to American audiences mainly, but what should any of us do? Or what should the American people do? I've attended some conferences where I've heard people who are onto this and, you know, see that something demonic is going on and are talking about what to do. Well, they have various ideas. Impeach the president. Put him on trial for treason. Perhaps not a bad idea. But would that really get to the root of the problem? Presidents come and go. Lying, greed, and corruption stay in place. Maybe we should unseat those neoconservative Republicans and vote in the liberal Democrats, which in fact is pretty much what happened in the latest American election. Will that solve the problem? The same money and power own both parties, as you probably have experience here in India. The big corporations invest equally in both parties so that whoever wins, they win. Put power back into the hands of the people, where it belongs. Nice slogan. But that's all it is. Overturn the American financial, military, industrial complex. You know where the power really is. Overturn it. You're dreaming. That's like overturning Mount Everest. Fight imperialism, empire building. Another dream. Whatever you do, empires will come and go and be replaced by new ones. We have a short historical overview here. From the point of view of cosmic time, an empire lasts hardly 3 seconds. To truly have meaning, changes have to take us beyond the limits of the material world. So then, what actually should we do? First is, we should know what sort of world we're living in. That we learn from Bhagavad Gita, what kind of world this really is. Not a place of enjoyment. A miserable pandemonium. And we should stand with the godly people, not with the demonic. We should get out of this material world. We shouldn't stay here and try to enjoy or be